When the animals come to us, asking for our help, will we know what they are saying? When the plants speak to us, in their delicate, beautiful language, will we be able to answer them? When the planet herself sings to us in our dreams, will we be able to wake ourselves and act? When we know that the animals and plants are part of who we are, we can listen and respond. Ignoring the trees is like ignoring our lungs when they are congested and we can't breathe. Extinction of the songbirds means the end of our living music. When the planet herself calls to us in our dreams, if we are in touch with the truth of our mutual belonging, our hearts naturally stir with care. We remember that the web of life is our home. The Bodhisattva's aspiration, "May life be of benefit to all beings," is a powerful tool for remembering our belonging and widening the circles of our compassion. In resolving to help all suffering beings, the Bodhisattva is not assuming a grandiose role or holding to some unreachable ideal. If we see ourselves as small and separate individuals trying to take on the world as our responsibility, we set ourselves up for delusion and failure. Rather, our aspiration to be of benefit arises from the radical realization that we all belong to the web of life, and that everything that happens within it affects everything else. Every thought we have, every action we take, has an impact for good or for ill. An Aboriginal woman from Australia speaks from this sense of relatedness in a powerful way. "If you have come to help me, then you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your destiny is bound up with mine, then let us work together." When we feel our togetherness, there are countless ways to express our care. Some people focus their lives on creating a loving home for their families, others on changing laws that will help poor children get better nutrition and education. Some people pray for hours in solitude, and others are always on the phone. While it is easy to get caught up in believing we should be doing something more or different, what really matters is that we care. As Mother Teresa teaches, we can do no great things, only small things with great love. Just as a bright sun causes ice cubes to melt, in the moments when we feel connected and kind, we create a warm environment that encourages others around us to relax and open up. Each time we widen the circle of caring, with a smile, a hug, a listening presence, a prayer, the ripples flow out endlessly. When we offer comfort to the person sitting by our side, our kindness spreads through the world. Whether offered inwardly or to others, the Bodhisattva's compassion is a gentle rain that touches, without bias, all of life. Guided Meditation, Tonglen, Awakening the Heart of Compassion. The Tibetan practice of Tonglen cultivates the all-embracing heart of compassion. Tonglen means taking in and sending out. Linked to the flow of the breath, this practice trains you to open directly to suffering, your own and that of all beings, and offer relief and care. The following meditation is a version of Tonglen that can help you awaken compassion in the face of suffering. There are times when Tonglen may be inappropriate. If you are struggling with the terror of having been abused, with unrelenting depression or severe emotional imbalance, Tonglen may cause emotional flooding or a deepened feeling of being stuck. In these situations, rather than practicing Tonglen, seek guidance from a therapist, a teacher familiar with this practice, or a trusted spiritual guide. Sit in a way that allows you to be relaxed and alert. Feeling the natural rhythm of your breath, let your body and mind settle. The traditional practice of Tonglen begins with a flash of remembrance, recognizing the awakened heart and mind. With your eyes open, Take a brief moment to sense the immensity of space and the natural openness and emptiness of awareness. Now bring to mind an experience of suffering. It might be your own pain or the suffering of someone close to you, a friend or family member, a pet or other living being. Let yourself feel this suffering in an immediate, vivid, close-in way. Let it be real to you, the loss, hurt, or fear. As you breathe in, allow this pain to come fully into your body and heart. If it is another being's pain, feel it as if it is your own. Open to the intensity of sensations, whatever they are. Now, as you breathe out, let the pain you are experiencing be released. Let go into the openness of awareness, letting the pain be ventilated in the freshness of open space. With the exhale, offer whatever prayer or expression of care comes naturally to you. For instance, may you be free of suffering. I care about your suffering. I wish you could be happy and peaceful. You might find that at first you don't actually feel connected to the suffering of hurt, fear, or grief. If this is the case, for a few minutes you might let your primary focus be with the in-breath and the taking in of pain. Pay special attention to the sensations that arise in your body. Then, as you begin to experience the suffering more fully, resume a balanced practice of taking in suffering and sending out relief. Without any judgment, be aware of how you are relating to suffering. At times you may feel a courageous willingness to open to the intensity and rawness of pain. At other times, you may feel fearful, and your heart may be defended or numb. If you feel resistance, you can do Tonglen with the sensations of resistance. You can do Tonglen with whatever experience arises. Breathe in the feelings of fear or numbness, touching them fully. Breathe out forgiveness, offering the resistance into the spaciousness of awareness. Whether you are feeling willing or resistant, continue practicing with the breath, taking in the raw sensations of suffering and sending out relief, letting go into openness. Now bring to mind all the other beings in the world who experience the same kind of suffering that you have been reflecting on. Sense how, while stories may differ, our actual experience of physical pain and emotional distress is the same. If you are meditating on the pain of feeling inadequate and rejected, in this moment, millions of other people are feeling the same pain. Sensing the realness of this suffering, begin to breathe in on behalf of all those who suffer in this way. Breathe in the insecurity, grief, or hurt that all these beings are feeling, and experience the intensity and fullness of their pain in your heart. As you breathe out, release this enormity of suffering into boundless space. Let it be held in boundless awareness. As before, with the out-breath, offer whatever prayer might alleviate the suffering. Continue breathing in and out, opening to the universal experience of this suffering and letting go into spaciousness with prayer. As your heart opens to the enormity of suffering, you become that openness. By offering your tenderness, your awareness becomes suffused with compassion. Continuing to breathe in suffering and breathe out care, sense your heart as a transformer of sorrows. Whenever you become aware of suffering, you can practice Tonglen. You might see on the TV news a family who has just lost their home in a flood or fire. You might be traveling on the freeway and see a car accident. You might be at an AA meeting, listening as someone describes his or her struggle with alcoholism. Right on the spot, you can breathe in, letting yourself feel the immediacy and sharpness of that hurt and fear. Exhaling, release the pain into the openness of awareness with a prayer for relief. After spending some minutes in this way, enlarge the field of compassion, breathing for all beings who are suffering from loss or trauma or addiction. 10. Recognizing our basic goodness, the gateway to a forgiving and loving heart. Like a caring mother, holding and guarding the life of her only child, so with a boundless heart, hold yourself and all beings. Buddha. I am larger and better than I thought. I did not think I held so much goodness. Walt Whitman. Amy arrived at her therapy session flushed and agitated. During the 2 months I'd been seeing her, she had been quiet, almost repressed. The main issue we'd worked on together was lack of self-worth. In this session, Amy launched into telling me how she discovered that her husband had been having an affair. Over the past half year, he'd been spending an increasing number of weekends away on work-related projects. Suspicious, Amy had decided one day the previous week to look through the email he received on his company account. Numerous messages from one woman, a colleague at work, had a tone of intimacy that left her shaking with rage. When Amy confronted Don that evening, he went pale and then, looking defeated and sad, nodded and said, "You're right. It's true." He wanted to keep talking, to explain, but she couldn't listen. She told him it was all over and that she'd never be able to forgive him. After admitting his infidelity that first evening, Don had ended the affair. He pleaded with Amy to forgive him, to give their marriage a chance. Too angry to give him any assurances, Amy at first maintained a stony silence. Later she told him that if it weren't for their daughter Celia, she would already have ended the marriage. Ever since that night, she said, her mind had been flooded with thoughts about how he had misled her, telling her he needed to attend a conference, or stay late at work, or go to a team planning meeting. Her anger at being betrayed burned in her chest like an immense red fire. He was a sleazy liar, a heartless fiend. Everything he said was part of a web of deception. The whole marriage was a sham. When we have been betrayed, one of our first reactions is to lash out in blame. We create a story of good and bad and aim our anger at the one who has caused us pain. With deep resentment, we build a case against them, often with enough evidence to prove we should eliminate them from our life altogether. The word resentment means to feel again. Each time we repeat to ourselves a story of how we've been wronged, we feel again in our body and mind the anger at being violated. But often enough, our resentment of others reflects our resentment of ourselves. When someone rejects us, he or she might be reinforcing a view we already hold, that we're not good enough, not kind enough, not lovable enough. While at first Amy focused her resentment and anger on Don, she soon turned them against herself. Don's affair had confirmed her worst fear. She deserved to be thrown aside. Every way in which she felt inadequate was reinforced by his rejection. She might appear warm and caring to the world, but inside she felt fake, wooden, grotesque. Don was the one who knew her best, and he had rejected her. Now, lost in the trance of unworthiness, Amy was convinced she was unlovable. Especially when things seem to be falling apart. We lose a job, suffer a serious injury, become estranged from a loved one. Our lives can become painfully bound by the experience that something is wrong with us. We buy into the belief that we are fundamentally flawed, bad, and undeserving of love. Like Amy, we forget our goodness and feel cut off from our heart. The Buddha taught, however, that no matter how lost in delusion we might be, our essence, our Buddha nature, is pure and undefiled. Tibetan meditation master Chogyam Jumpa writes, "Every human being has a basic nature of goodness. basic goodness is the radiance of our Buddha nature. It is our intrinsic wakefulness and love. This doesn't mean we can do no wrong. But in sharp contrast to our cultural conditioning as heirs of Adam and Eve, the Buddhist perspective holds that there is no such thing as a sinful or evil person. When we harm ourselves or others, it is not because we are bad, but because we are ignorant. To be ignorant is to ignore the truth that we are connected to all of life, and that grasping and hatred create more separation and suffering. To be ignorant is to ignore the purity of awareness and capacity for love that expresses our basic goodness. To recognize this basic goodness in everyone takes courage. Jhampa calls this the task of the spiritual warrior, and says that the essence of human bravery is refusing to give up on anyone or anything. This can be especially hard when we're trying to see the goodness in a murderer, the CEO of a corporation that pollutes the planet, a child molester. Basic goodness can be buried under an ugly tangle of fear, greed, and hostility. And seeing it doesn't mean overlooking harmful behavior in ourselves or others. To radically accept life depends upon clearly seeing the full truth of it. Novelist and mystic Romain Rolland says, "There is only one heroism in the world, to see the world as it is and to love it." Seeing the world as it is means seeing not only the vulnerability and suffering of each person, but also the basic goodness of each person. When we embrace ourselves and others with radical acceptance, we are seeing past the roles, stories, and behaviors that obscure our true nature. Seeing the goodness in others begins with seeing the goodness in ourselves. Even when we feel ashamed or depressed, resentful or insecure, we don't give up on ourselves. In traditional Buddhist teachings, there are formal meditations designed to free us from trance and reconnect us with the goodness and loving awareness that is our true nature. These often begin with forgiveness, for it releases the armor of resentment and blame that surrounds our heart and prevents us from feeling the goodness in ourselves and others. The practices of loving kindness awaken the love that is the flower of our goodness. The radical acceptance at the center of these practices depends upon a leap of faith. Our trance thoughts may tell us that something is wrong, but we dare to let go of them and trust in the possibility of goodness. Our body may be filled with painful emotions, but instead of running away, we entrust ourselves to the healing power of compassionate presence. We may have protected ourselves by closing our heart, but instead, for the sake of love, we refuse to push anyone, including ourselves, out of our heart. When we are willing to leap, our faith is not disappointed, for when we peel off the layers of delusion, we find the goodness and love that are always there. Forgiving ourselves, releasing the blame that binds our heart. At our next session, Amy poured out a litany of her personal failings. She was an inadequate mother. She was a bad wife. Everywhere, at home, at work, she was a fumbling, failing person. She was acutely aware of how distant she and her 14-year-old daughter Celia had become from each other. They seldom really talked, and Amy knew little about what Celia thought or felt. It shouldn't have been such a surprise that Dawn would turn to another woman. Who would want to be faithful to someone as bitchy and selfish as she was? She was always criticizing how messy he was, the way he planned their vacations, the way he drove the car. A particular episode stood out in her mind. One night during the past year, they had been lying in bed together, and Dawn had started telling her about an argument he had with his boss. Amy had interrupted angrily. "Okay, just say it. Did you go and ruin your chances for a promotion? Did you screw up?" Dawn got out of bed and stood for a moment in the dark. "No," Amy," he said simply, and left the room. He didn't come back to bed that night or the next. After telling me this, Amy sat back and looked down at the floor. In a weary voice, she said, "I don't know who I am more mad at, Don or myself." Whether our anger and resentment is directed at another or at ourselves, the result is the same. It removes us from the deeper pain of our hurt and shame. As long as we avoid these feelings, we remain trapped in our armor, locked away from love for ourselves and others. As we have seen over and over, the way out begins with radical acceptance of our pain. When we release our stories of blame and let ourselves directly experience the feelings of shame and fear in our body, we begin regarding ourselves with compassion. Rather than living in reaction to past events, rather than identifying ourselves as an angry person, a betrayed person, a bad person, we free ourselves to meet the present moment with wisdom and kindness. This is the essence of forgiveness. Whether we are angry with ourselves or others, we forgive by letting go of blame and opening to the pain we have tried to push away. But when we have deeply turned against ourselves, forgiveness can seem impossible. Like Marion in her guilt over Christie's sexual abuse, when we feel we've caused great suffering, we can't imagine feeling compassion for ourselves. I asked Amy, "Do you think you could forgive yourself for being that critical person? For making those mistakes?" She responded without hesitation, "No. Forgiving myself would just let me off the hook. How would that make me a better mother or a better wife?" I gently continued, "Is there anything else that stops you from forgiving yourself, Amy?" With some bitterness, she replied, "Why should I forgive myself? It wouldn't help those I've already hurt. I've already ruined my family. It's too late." But I knew that a part of Amy desperately wanted to remove the noose of self-hatred around her neck. I asked, "What would happen if, just for a short time, you put aside your story of being a bad person?" She said she didn't know, but she was willing to try it. As I guided her to placing her attention on the feelings in her body, Amy said she felt as if she were dropping into a deep hole of shame, a swamp of badness. Within moments, a memory from years ago sprang into her mind. Amy saw herself in her office at home, irritated by Celia's persistent whining. She literally dragged her daughter by one arm into their den and, turning on the TV, forbade her to leave the room. She left her locked in for 2 hours, ignoring her periodic cries to be let out. After telling me this, she asked, "Tara, how am I supposed to forgive myself for treating my child like that? I feel so ashamed of myself." I suggested to Amy that instead of trying to forgive herself, she might just send a message of forgiveness to the shame. "Can you forgive the shame for existing?" I asked. Amy nodded, then whispered, "I forgive this shame. I forgive this shame." She was silent for what seemed a long time, so I asked what was happening. "Well," she began slowly, "it doesn't feel like shame anymore. Now it's more like fear." I let her know that she could be with the fear in the same way, letting it be there, feeling it, offering it forgiveness. After a few minutes, Amy said, "I know what I'm afraid of, that I'll never be close to anyone. I push everyone away. I don't want anyone to see what I'm really like." Crying, Amy covered her face. I gently reminded her to forgive this, too. The fear, and now this grief. If she wanted, I told her, she could simply say, "Forgiven. Forgiven." Hugging her knees into her chest and rocking back and forth, Amy forgave and open to the grief that had lain buried under her resentments. There were so many times when I could have been loving but wasn't. With Celia, with Dawn, with my friends. No matter what appears, burning rage, gnawing anxiety, cruel thoughts, or utter despondency, by offering forgiveness directly to each, we give permission to our inner life to be as it is. Rather than forgiving a self, we forgive the experiences we are identified with. While resistance keeps us stuck by hardening our heart and contracting our body and mind, saying, "I forgive this," or "forgiven," creates a warmth and softness that allow emotions to unfold and change. When her grief finally subsided, Amy's body became very still, her face relaxed. She let her head rest against the back of the chair, and her breathing grew long and slow. When she looked at me, her eyes were red and swollen, yet peaceful. Still curled up in her chair, Amy told me about coming home from second grade and finding a stray dog sniffing around their garbage. "It was love at first sight," she said. And when it seemed her parents were going to take the dog to a shelter, Amy cried and cried. As it turned out, the family adopted Rudy, and he became the first of a string of stray creatures, including several more dogs, kittens, and an injured bird that Amy took into her care. Amy's face softened as she said, "Everyone used to say I was so kind to animals. I just loved them. They were my friends." She joked about how Dawn's mild but real allergies were the only line of defense against her now creating a full-blown menagerie. Then, in a quieter voice, she said, "You know, I do care about people, about animals. I've always been like that." As she spoke these words, I could tell that she was beginning to open the door to her own healing. "Amy, you are a good person. I hope you can let yourself trust this." I asked her if she had any photographs of herself with her pets. If so, she might spend some time with them. She might also take a look at some of her baby pictures, just to see what she noticed. As we ended the session, I reminded Amy that forgiving ourselves and learning to trust our goodness can take a long time. I told her that some days I need to forgive myself over and over, 20 times, 30 times. I usually don't use a formal meditation to do so. I simply recognize that I'm judging or disliking myself and bring compassion to the pain I'm feeling. I consciously hold the intention to let go of blame and try to be more kind to myself. Each night before going to sleep, I suggested she might do a forgiveness scan, scanning to see if she was holding anything against herself from the day. She might have made a mistake at work or said something condescending to her husband. If she realized that she was down on herself, she could feel the pain of her self-blame, the fear or anger or shame, and send the message, "Forgiven, forgiven." She might also gently remind herself that she was doing the best she could. Forgiving ourselves is a process that continues through our whole life. We are so used to replaying the story of what is wrong with ourselves and others that living with a resentful, tight heart can become our most familiar way of being. Thousands of times we might find ourselves caught in stories of what we are doing wrong. Thousands of times we might drop under our blame to where the deeper pain lives. With each round of freeing ourselves through forgiveness, we strengthen our recognition of our basic goodness. As Amy found, we begin to trust again that we care about life. With time, forgiving ourselves utterly transfigures our life. We all know stories of prisoners on death row who, through honestly facing the suffering they caused, were able to forgive themselves. By opening to the enormity of pain, their hearts became tender and awake. Other inmates, guards, prison chaplains, and relatives could recognize the glow of their inner freedom. These prisoners were not letting themselves off the hook. While taking full responsibility for their actions, they were also able to recognize the truth of their basic goodness. We might worry, as Amy did, that forgiving ourselves is in some way condoning harmful behavior, or giving ourselves permission to continue in hurtful ways. When we forgive ourselves, we are not saying, "I couldn't help doing what I did, so I might as well forget about it." Nor are we pushing away responsibility when we release our blaming thoughts. Feeling guilty and bad about ourselves for something we've done might temporarily restrain us from doing harm. But ultimately, blaming and hating ourselves only leads to further harmful actions. We can't punish ourselves into being a good person. Only by holding ourselves with the compassion of forgiveness do we experience our goodness and respond to our circumstances with wisdom and care. Learning to see our own goodness. Amy barely spoke to Don for the next few weeks. He was sleeping on the living room couch, and she wasn't really sure what to do next. She told me she didn't want to end the marriage, but she just couldn't pretend everything was normal and let him get away with what he'd done. Despite Amy's pain and uncertainty, I could see in our sessions that something was shifting and opening inside her. Amy came to our next session with a small packet of photos. She laid them out on the coffee table, and we sat side by side on the couch to look at them. One was of Amy as an infant, cradled to her mother's breast, and we both smiled at the sweet, wide-eyed little person in the picture. In another, she was about 2, sitting on her father's shoulders, hugging his head and laughing. Amy grinned. "You know, it makes me happy to see her happy." In the others, taken when she was 8 or 9, Amy was with her adopted friends, cuddling Rudy, lying in bed with their kitten Sam sleeping on her chest, carefully holding a small bird in her hands. As we looked at her with her animals, Amy told me she could remember how it felt to be a good person. "When you told me that last week, Tara, it was hard to take in. But looking at these, I think I can feel it right now. That goodness and innocence, they're still inside me." To even consider remembering her goodness depended on Amy's letting go of her belief that she was bad and unlovable. In our previous session, she had started the process of forgiveness, opening to her pain and holding it with compassion. She said the forgiveness scan had also helped. One night, as she remembered how distracted and inefficient she'd been with her real estate clients, she simply let herself feel the anxiety and shame in her body and forgave it for being there. Amy smiled and said, "I realized I could be uptight and still be a good person." As Amy began collecting her photos, I got up and took a book off my office shelf and turned to one of my favorite poems. I read aloud to Amy a few lines written by the poet Kabir. "We sense that there is some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and the ants. Perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. This makes me think of you, of your loving spirit, Amy. I think those animals you cared for helped you remember who you were." Smiling in agreement, she patted the stack of photos. "These belong on my altar. If there was ever a time I needed regular reminding, this is it." Reflecting on our own goodness is considered a skillful means in Buddhist practice because it opens our hearts and invigorates our faith in our spiritual unfolding. If we're caught up in considering ourselves bad, we contract and hide. In contrast, if we trust our goodness, we open up to others, we feel inspired to help others, we move forward on our spiritual path with dedication and joy. There are several practices that are traditionally offered as ways to remember our goodness. We might begin by simply reflecting on certain qualities or behaviors that we appreciate in ourselves. For instance, when I recall instances of being kind to someone, I can taste the sweetness of being caring and generous. I might remember a time when I put aside my own agenda to stop and listen deeply to someone, or spontaneously gave a friend a book she might like. When I feel moved by the music of Mozart, or awed by a starry night sky, I feel part of the goodness and beauty of life. When life strikes me as funny, I feel real and human and basically good. Sometimes, though, the idea of appreciating myself can feel awkward or self-serving. When this is the case, it feels more honest to acknowledge my basic desire to be happy, to recognize that I, like all human beings, long to be loved, yearn to feel my goodness. When I pay attention to the depth of these longings, I reconnect to a genuine feeling of warmth toward myself. Sometimes the easiest way to appreciate ourselves is by looking through the eyes of someone who loves us. A friend told me that when he sees himself through the eyes of his spiritual teacher, he remembers how deeply devoted he is to seeking the truth. One of my clients realizes he is lovable when he remembers how his grandfather used to delight in his boyish curiosity and inventiveness. Sometimes, seeing ourselves through the eyes of a close friend can help us remember our good qualities. Our friend might love our humor and warmth, our passion about saving the environment, our honest willingness to say what's really going on in our lives. We don't have to limit our appreciators to the human world. I once saw a bumper sticker that said, "Lord, help me to see myself the way my dog sees me." We might ask ourselves, what makes our dog happy to see us? Even if the answer is just that he wants to get fed or walked, our animal's appreciation of our constancy reflects an aspect of us that is worthy. The practice of looking through the eyes of one who loves us can be a powerful and surprisingly direct way to remember our beauty and goodness. Through the simple practice of seeing our own goodness, we undo the deeply rooted habits of blame and self-hate that keep us feeling isolated and unworthy. The contemporary Indian master, Bapuji, lovingly reminds us to cherish our goodness. "My beloved child, break your heart no longer. Each time you judge yourself, you break your own heart. You stop feeding on the love which is the wellspring of your vitality. The time has come. Your time, to live, to celebrate, and to see the goodness that you are. Let no one, no thing, no idea or ideal obstruct you. If one comes, even in the name of truth, forgive it for its unknowing. Do not fight. Let go. And breathe into the goodness that you are." Every time we betray ourselves by not seeing our goodness, we break our heart. When we judge ourselves for falling short, we break our heart. Although Amy had been breaking her heart for years, she was now beginning to see her goodness and move toward healing. Because how we see ourselves is so deeply influenced by our relationships, for Amy, this trust in her goodness would be deepened when she felt forgiven by another. The blessing of feeling forgiven. Driving home one late afternoon from the office, Amy found herself stuck in rush hour traffic. She arrived home with little time to prepare dinner. Don was out of town, and her new boss and her husband were coming over for the evening. When she walked into the kitchen, she discovered the countertops stacked with dishes covered in tomato sauce and several half-drunk cans of soda sitting around. Amy exploded. She stormed into Celia's room, turned off the blaring music, and sent her daughter's friends home. When the door shut behind them, she lit into Celia. "How could you be so thoughtless? You knew we were having company." Celia started to say, "All you had to do was ask me," but Amy interrupted her, yelling that she shouldn't have to go around pleading for help. "Your friends and your music are all that matter. You don't give a damn about anything else." Amy slammed Celia's door as she left the room. In the silence that followed, Amy could hear the echo of her voice screaming. Her heart was pounding, and her breath was fast and shallow. Suddenly, an image of her daughter as a toddler came into her mind, and she remembered how Celia used to pick bouquets of dandelions for her. Another image immediately arose of her and Celia weaving spring flowers into each other's hair, turning themselves into May Queens. Amy turned and knocked softly on the door. Celia opened it and stood waiting.
"I can't believe it, Celia. I can't believe I'm doing this to you."
Amy sat down on the bed, and it all came pouring out. She was sorry for making their lives so miserable. Sorry for what was happening between her and Celia's dad. Sorry for the kind of mother she was. Sorry for not being there enough for Celia. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Celia was silent for a while. Then she said,
"Mom, no one's perfect. But I've always known you loved me. Isn't that what counts?"
Amy looked into her daughter's clear blue eyes and knew she was speaking the truth. Celia had never doubted that her mother cared about her. Even when Amy was anxious and frazzled and critical, Celia had felt her love and known it was unshakable. Certainly, she'd felt angry at her mother and sometimes didn't want to be around her, but she knew Amy was there if she needed her. Amy felt a great wave of relief. Instead of feeling guilty and despicable, she felt forgiven. In the following days, when Amy noticed herself being bitchy and critical, when she remembered Celia's sweet blue eyes, the painful grip of self-blame began to relax. Even though the habit of judging herself continued, the feelings of badness didn't build up until they took over. Because Celia had forgiven her, Amy was gentler and kinder toward herself. To know we are forgiven can be deeply liberating, especially when the acceptance embraces our failings with compassion. I heard a moving story about a woman in the hospital dying of AIDS. She had lived the last decade of her life addicted to heroin, not caring where she got her next fix, just so long as she got it. The only person she had ever loved was her daughter, yet even this love had not stopped her from destroying her own life. One day, a young Catholic priest was making his rounds at a community hospital, and he came upon this woman, emaciated and with the yellow tinge of an afflicted liver. He sat down next to her bed and asked how she was doing.
"I'm lost," she replied. "I've ruined my life and every life around me. There is no hope for me. I'm going to hell."
The priest sat in silence for a few moments. Then he noticed a framed picture of a pretty girl on the dresser.
"Who is that?" he asked.
The woman brightened a little.
"She's my daughter, the one beautiful thing in my life."
"And would you help her if she was in trouble or made a mistake? Would you forgive her? Would you still love her?"
"Of course I would," cried the woman. "I would do anything for her. She will always be precious and beautiful to me."
"Why do you ask such a question?"
"Because I want you to know," said the priest, "that God has a picture of you on his dresser."
In his message of unconditional forgiveness and love, the priest was giving back to this woman her goodness and innocence. From a Buddhist perspective, when we can regard our mistakes and transgressions with the eyes of compassion, we release the ignorance that keeps us bound in hating and blaming ourselves. We see that our imperfections don't taint our basic goodness. This is what it means to feel forgiven. Aware of our true nature,
We know nothing is wrong. Feeling forgiven is a sure way to open the heart. This power is recognized in traditional Buddhist practices. Before beginning the meditation practice of sending loving kindness to all beings, we first silently ask forgiveness of anyone we may have harmed, intentionally or unintentionally. Even this basic gesture of asking forgiveness softens our heart. We can open further to the possibility of being forgiven by reflecting on specific people we may have harmed and silently asking their forgiveness. As Amy found, feeling forgiven by others can allow us to more deeply forgive ourselves. Another step in the traditional forgiveness practice is offering forgiveness to ourselves. When we have released the painful armor of self-blame by feeling forgiven by ourselves and others, we can then, in our meditation, sincerely offer forgiveness to others. Forgiving others. Not pushing anyone out of our heart. Like every part of living, forgiving has its own natural process of unfolding. Often we are not ready to forgive ourselves, not able to forgive someone who has injured us. We can't will ourselves to forgive. Forgiving is a product not of effort, but of openness. This is why the intention to forgive is such a key element in the process. To be willing but not quite ready to forgive holds the door open a crack. Having the courage not to push anyone out of our heart is difficult enough when we've been harmed by someone we know. But as spiritual warriors, our intention not to give up on anyone may be most severely tested when we are deeply violated by someone with whom we have no loving ties. How do we forgive a stranger who rapes our daughter? A political terrorist who kills our friend with a bomb? A student at one of my meditation retreats told me of her struggle to forgive the man who left her son unable to walk for life. One evening, she had picked up Brian from a bar mitzvah class, and on the way home, a drunk driver crossed over the median and struck their car. She suffered minor injuries, but Brian was pinned to the ground when their car turned over, his legs crushed. Forgiveness was a long and painful process. Thousands of times she felt the burn of anger and the anguish of loss storm through her. She also felt the hardening of her heart when hatred wanted to take over. Knowing that the only way to find her way back to love and freedom would be through forgiveness, she took on the intention to forgive the man. Gradually over the years, as she allowed the feelings to course through her, forgiving them as they arose, her heart widened to include him. Without knowing any particulars, she knew he too suffered. She knew he had not intended to cause them pain. Eventually, by remembering the goodness of all beings, she opened to hold him with a forgiving heart. We maintain the intention to forgive because we understand that not forgiving hardens and imprisons our heart. If we feel hatred toward anyone, we remain chained to the sufferings of the past and cannot find genuine peace. We forgive for the freedom of our own heart. For the first 6 months after discovering Don's affair, Amy's hurt and rage had been so intense she couldn't imagine ever forgiving him. But as her heart opened in forgiving herself, it began to dawn on her that in time she might feel different about Don. She told me one day that she actually intended to forgive him when she was ready. It happened almost imperceptibly. Amy would notice how kind he was to Celia, how carefully he listened to her, and her heart would soften a little. When a friend of theirs got sick, she saw how helpful Don was, driving him to the doctor's office, getting takeout food for him each evening. And he certainly was trying hard enough to be nice to her, clearly making efforts to compliment her when she got dressed for work, making sure he told her exactly where he was going and how she could reach him when he was out of town. At dinner one night, she found herself laughing at a story Don was telling about the performance of his company's amateur volleyball team. As he went on, she remembered how much she appreciated the way he could put a comic spin on just about anything. There were still many moments when the full feeling of betrayal would sweep through her. But something was changing. Amy wasn't sure just when it happened. But she told me that one day she found herself looking at the photographs of their wedding hanging on the hallway wall. And she realized Don wasn't really a bad person. He had made a big mistake, and maybe it had brought home something really painful to her about herself. But he wasn't evil or malicious. There never was a moment in time when I thought, "Okay, I forgive him," she told me. Just somewhere along the line, I no longer needed to push him away so hard. It may not have been entirely clear to Amy, but I could see that over the course of our work together, the better she felt about herself, the more open she felt toward Don. Seeing her own goodness opened her up to seeing his. As sometimes happens when one partner in a couple has an affair, over time, Amy and Don did find their way back to each other and to a deeper and more honest relationship. Both had changed. But I attributed their success in large part to Amy's willingness to accept and forgive the feelings hidden beneath her sense of unworthiness. Our intention and willingness to forgive, to let go of resentment and blame, does not mean that we excuse harmful behaviors or allow further injury. For Amy, forgiving didn't mean she approved of Don's way of expressing dissatisfaction with the marriage, or in any way condoned his deceit. She insisted that they do couples counseling, and she continued in therapy herself. Forgiving didn't mean she became a doormat or denied feeling angry at times. Nor did it mean she would sit back if her husband ever again betrayed their marriage. She could see Don's goodness and still set boundaries. When we forgive, we stop rigidly identifying others by their undesirable behavior. Without denying anything, we open our heart and mind wide enough to see the deeper truth of who they are. We see their goodness. When we do, our hearts naturally open in love. Seeing the goodness in others. When Narayan was younger, I used to sit by his bed while he was sleeping and reflect on who he was. While I watched his sweet face and gently breathing form, I'd do a practice of intentionally trying to see past his physical appearance to who he really was. Whatever thoughts or images came to mind, I'd notice and put aside. My heart would warm to remember how he asked questions or played with our dog, or said, "Love you, Mama." But I'd ask again, "Who are you, really?" The question guided me beyond all my ideas of him, and revealed his nature to me as awareness, as aliveness loving life. I'd also direct the question, "Who am I?" to myself, and look behind the idea of being the mother, behind my identification with a physical body, behind any thoughts of what I was doing there, sitting by the side of his bed. Again, what was revealed was pure awareness and love. We were the same. There was no separation between us, no difference in who we both really are. Like myself, most parents have watched their sleeping children and felt a pure and uncomplicated upwelling of tenderness. When they are sleeping, we don't have to say no to the 10th cookie, hurry them up for the carpool, or fend them off when we are trying to get through a phone call. When they are sleeping, we can deepen our attention and see through to the sweetness and innocence of their soul. In our attempts to give up on no one, a useful practice can be to imagine others as infants or children. Another method that can lead us to the precious being outside personality and roles
is to imagine that we are seeing someone for the last time, or even that they have already passed away. By letting go of our habitual ways of defining others, we can see the radiant awareness, the goodness of their true nature. Most of us, however, fall into the habit of pinning a narrow and static identity on those around us. All too often this is based on behaviors we find unpleasant or annoying. We might fixate on how stubborn or rude our child is, or how a colleague brags about his accomplishments. If someone has offended us, we feel wary and guarded each time we see them. If our partner makes a cutting remark to us before leaving for work in the morning, we are ready for more of the same in the evening. We forget that every person, including ourselves, is new every moment. In his play, The Cocktail Party, T.S. Eliot writes, "What we know of other people is only our memory of the moments during which we knew them, and they have changed since then. We must also remember that at every meeting we are meeting a stranger. While we can, of course, recognize patterns of behavior in ourselves and others, our collection of assumptions doesn't define a person. When we stop and ask, 'Who are you, really?' we are led to a deeper understanding. As I found with Narayan, we see inherent goodness, we see Buddha nature, and invariably, we respond with love." Awakening the Heart of Loving Kindness. The quality of tenderness and love and goodwill that naturally awakens in us in response to seeing goodness is known in Buddhism as metta, or loving kindness. While loving kindness is intrinsic to who we are, it can also be cultivated through a refined set of practices that have been passed down in an unbroken line of teachings over the past 2,500 years. When we feel love for someone, we spontaneously wish for their happiness and well-being. This response has been formalized in what is known as the practice of loving kindness. Traditionally, we begin this meditation by reflecting on the goodness in ourselves and offering simple phrases of care. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be filled with loving kindness. These are the standard phrases used, but any prayer for well-being that resonates with our heart is an expression of loving kindness. Like the widening circles of compassion, loving kindness begins with ourselves and then opens out to include others. Those we love, those we consider neutral, those we may have a hard time feeling goodwill toward, and ultimately, all beings everywhere. When we send loving kindness to those we love, we begin with someone in whom we most easily perceive goodness. If our heart becomes most tender when we reflect on our child or on our grandmother, then we begin with them. We might remember what makes that person so dear to us and offer them phrases of care. As we say, "May you be happy," and feel into the meaning of that prayer, we can imagine them brightening and glowing with happiness. As we do so, our feelings of warmth grow even stronger and we more deeply appreciate who they are. Widening our circle to include in loving kindness those we experience as challenging requires the courage of the spiritual warrior. Even with those who bring up feelings of anger or dislike in us, we seek to find some small quality we can appreciate. When I'm feeling dislike for someone, I find it helpful to imagine that person being warmed and comforted in the embrace of someone who loves them. Or I might think of them as sincerely praying, or being filled with wonder as they walk through newly fallen snow. When we imagine someone in these ways, the idea is not to invent something or deny our perceptions or feelings. Rather, we are looking beyond our habitual judgments in order to see the beauty that is truly there. The Dalai Lama says, "Everyone wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer." Even if there is little that seems good about those we feel distant from, we can still remember that, like us, they want to be happy and free from suffering. While it can be